Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the economic crises are pushing more people into homelessness, an already pervasive epidemic in America. We'll explore one duo's efforts to rescue some of the most vulnerable homeless women, one by one, and explore the system's workings and failures from their experience. Then on the Scholar Circle, why are so many people without homes, and what can be done about it? Wilhelmina was living in Maine with her family until she climbed aboard a bus to visit relatives. She disembarked at the wrong bus stop, became disoriented, and lost her way. Soon, Wilhelmina became one of the estimated 2.3 to 3.5 million people who experience homelessness in America in a given year. For years, Wilhelmina lived in the streets of Los Angeles until a Grammy Award-winning record producer, Robin Nixon, and a composer, musician, and documentary producer, Dennis Davis, discovered her sleeping at a bus stop. After months of battling bureaucracies and obstacles in the way of getting Wilhelmina the requisite assistance, these two Los Angeles men helped her find and reunite with her family. Now, with this experience, this duo have formed the Goal Foundation and are rescuing homeless women, one by one, in a similar manner. They join us now in studio. Thank you so much for being with us. Robin, I think you're the one that first began this effort, and you've said it was an accident.
That's right.
What happened?
How does one become a homeless advocate? I'm actually a music producer by trade, and I was driving back to my house from a recording studio session, and it was raining very heavily. This is about 3 or 4 years ago, and I saw a girl sitting to the side of a bus stop in the rain, and she looked completely emaciated, just absolutely starving. And I was stuck at the light, and she gestured to me for help, and as the light turned green, I drove off. I'd only just bought my house, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, this is my neighbor. So something happened, and I decided to help her. And I drove off to get some waterproof clothes and some food. And I went back and pulled her under a shelter and gave her the food. She was so weak, she couldn't even talk at this point. So that night, it continued to rain, and you know, rained heavily. I was woken up by the rain, in fact, at about 3 a.m, and I thought, oh my God, I need to go check on that girl, see how she's doing. And I went back, and of course, she's not doing that well. And the next day, I just continued to help her.
How old of a young woman is she?
It was really hard to see beneath, how to say, but dirt. I mean, she was completely covered in mud, and she's obviously been out for a length of time. Just a scraggly poor thing. I was guessing in her late teens. As we got to know her, it turns out that she is probably the mental age of around 16, but physical age, she's actually 38.
And she ended up homeless on the streets of Los Angeles. How?
It's a very complicated story, and we only have little bits and pieces that we have pieced together. It actually started 4 years ago in Maine, Portland, Maine, like the other side of America. And Wilhelmina had developed schizophrenia. And this was something that she had received medication for. And as with a lot of schizophrenics, they go off and on medication. When you feel well, you don't think you have a problem, so you don't take your medication. And the cycle is that when you don't take your medication, then you become unwell again. And it is a bit of a vicious cycle. So I guess she was probably on a cycle of being off her medication. And she was on a bus journey from one relative to another and didn't get off at the right stop. And this simple error led to her catastrophic journey. She didn't remember who she was. She didn't remember her address. And this little girl was lost. And so she went from one truck stop to another and just kept moving. And eventually we've traced a journey through Texas. And we really don't know all of the details, but somehow she ended up living at Metro 92 bus stop in Echo Park.
When you found her, you tried to steer her through the homeless system to get her really the help she needs. What were the steps that you took, and what were the roadblocks that you faced?
I really didn't know what I was doing, and I'm still learning every day. But we all reach to the internet, and so what am I going to do? How do I help this person? And I just pulled up as many resources as I could find. the most important part in the early stages of helping somebody on the street like this is actually building trust. You don't sit down and say, hey, do you want to have a place to stay? And they say yes. It's a much longer process. And so I guess that the first step before all of that was building up a system to look after her on the street. This is something I just kind of made up through trial and error. I would make up a bed for her in the evening at the bus stop. We even considered putting some walls up around it at one point. But then in the morning, I would come and pick up the bed. If we left the stuff out, it would get stolen. She'd, you know, go to the restroom or something, and then somebody else would take her stuff. So we basically had to put it down, pick it up. And then when I was at the studio, I'd be sending her pizza for delivery. And so, of course, the pizza delivery place knew me, and they'd be like, oh, yes, take it to Metro 92 bus stop, no problem. And she specifically knew exactly how she wanted her pizza. And
Dennis Davis?
Well, I came into the picture with Wilhelmina a couple months after Robin initially had reached out to her. And I was just taking my exercise routine, walking from my house to Echo Park, and I had seen Wilhelmina at the bus stop, and I just felt compelled to try to help her as well. And then I came to realize that someone obviously had been helping this girl somehow, because she had things in the evening, and then in the morning she wouldn't have things. And then one day I just happened to arrive there, and Robin was folding up blankets and taking in her bedding. And
had you two known each other before?
No.
You met at the bus stop helping Wilhelmina.
Yes.
Actually, I think the first words Dennis approached me said, you know, I see what you're doing. How can I help? So, I think my first words to him was like, well, start folding these blankets.
I said, I can do that. Kind of started this relationship of helping this girl. And
I really did need the help.
Having now seen this woman go from being completely homeless and alone on the wrong side of the country, living with nothing in a bus stop, who is going to die, essentially, to now having, you have really essentially helped her reunite with her family in Maine. How can we make sense of the parts of the system that work and don't work through your experience with this one particular woman?
I guess the part that is really quite, we're learning from other homeless advocates that this particular story is fairly unique, that in the process of helping her get off the street and onto a medication program, her memory started to come back, and she remembered a few numbers, and those numbers, in fact, were part of her social security number. So armed with just these few numbers, we managed to, with another agency, trace a missing person report from Maine. So we got to be on a phone call with a mother who had her daughter missing, presumed dead, for 4 years. And say,
4 years?
And so, you know, I got to be on a phone call with a mother saying, we found your daughter, which, as you can imagine, this is what I told you I would start crying. That day is something I'll never forget. And as you said, she is now living back with her mom. In fact, now she's looking after her mom. And we've actually gone out to visit.
It's quite extraordinary being able to go to Maine and visit Wilhelmina with her mother and get to see how healthy she became from what we had seen her through so much trouble. And
walk us through the steps now. So you had to get her some medication to start.
I guess the first step was we approached Mental Health LA. I don't want to throw people under the bus, but I have to say, in the defense of Mental Health LA, they have a huge problem on their hands. Ultimately, they are very, very overburdened as an agency. I had a conversation at one point with somebody from their agency that declined help for her because we were helping her. So I, being a little feisty, went to somebody higher up and said, your message to the general public in Los Angeles is that if you help somebody that's homeless, they don't qualify for help. So I had a phone call back saying, oh, we've made a big mistake. Or at least somebody in our department has made a big mistake, and we would like to throw some resources at this. So I said, well, meet me at the bus stop at 8 o'clock. Four white vans with lots of clipboards and goodwill. I managed to meet with everybody, and they brought down somebody else from another agency, and we signed papers on behalf of her and got her benefits and housing opportunity and medication, you know, doctors assigned. And so it really did take a push from us. And we're not there for all of the homeless people. I looked at the paperwork that I helped fill in. If you were homeless with mental health problems, I don't know how you would actually sign these. I don't know how you would understand the process. I don't know if you could do it. So we have a system that's designed to ask the blind to pick the green door, and then the help is there. But if you walk through the blue door, then you qualify. Definitely there's room for improvement.
It takes advocacy and outreach from third parties and someone outside of their family structure that can reach out to these people, because a lot of times the family can't deal with the problem for whatever reason. There's some kind of a disconnect, which I don't quite understand. There's probably scholars that understand this better than I, about the disconnect that happens between the schizophrenic child and their parent. From what I see, it takes a stranger to stop and take the time to outreach and advocate for that person to help navigate them through the massive paperwork and agencies and meetings with people.
How many agencies did you ultimately have to deal with to get her on her feet again?
I have a file folder that's about an inch and a half thick, and I called probably most of the, and this is fairly small print, so some agencies are religious-based. So if you're of a faith, then they'll help you. Other agencies only deal with various demographics, and so if you have to qualify, it's a lot of qualifications. It's really like, you know, round peg in a square hole. Ultimately, as Dennis mentioned, the only way that you actually can really help somebody is to extend that hand. They cannot do it themselves. It's impossible to say and expect somebody who's mentally disabled to help themselves. This is why we set up our foundation, because the bottom line, if there is one, is that we as a society should be able to take care of our handicapped and not expect them to take care of themselves. If your friend breaks a leg skiing, it's lots of sympathy cards and sign the cast. And if you tragically have a friend in a family that's dying of cancer, there's a lot of sympathy. And yet, if you are schizophrenic or have some mental disability, it's very much like turn the other way. We see this on a lot of levels. Even the Queen of England has two schizophrenic cousins. One passed away and the other is still not looked after. Famous people like David Bowie had a half-brother. They turned their back on him. There's quite a few.
I want to get a sense of how long it took between the time you found Wilhelmina and the time she was reunited with her mother, and how much you actually had to do and how many agencies you had to deal with.
The first priority is mental health. Medication is the bridge. You have to have a support system with medication, because that's the part that's going to develop better communication and a better understanding for that client. So the first priority is finding a doctor and a system. So we work with a company called Telecare. Along with that, you have to get them off the street. And the very first place that somebody in this condition goes to is very much like a lockdown. It's not pretty. It's not a jail, but you certainly are locked in for your own safety. Basically, you're medicated. And if you are in a certain condition where you really just do not know what's best for you, then there's certain doctors that will evaluate that person and you will have forced medication, which, again, it's not pretty, but it really is necessary. So when the person starts to level out, it takes about 2 weeks. And during that process, you have a social worker assigned, and then you evaluate what's the next step of housing, because that's really an intermediary emergency housing scenario. And then you look at steps for boarding care and, you know, places that have nurses on hand and, you know, meals and so on. And eventually, when they have stabilized, depending on how they qualify for, you know, Medicare or what their financial circumstance is, at that point they can potentially go into their own housing.
I think there was a span of time from when Robin actually first found her and got her into the first shelter was probably about 3 or 4 months of on the street every day, twice a day, three times a day, advocation for her and getting her well enough to accept going into a facility.
Dennis Davis, last time you and I spoke, you talked about another young woman that you have found and that you're also helping.
On my daily walking up to Echo Park, and then after meeting Robin, I had noticed this other young woman along the way and noticed her that, wow, there's another young woman here who's like homeless. And much later, after Wilhelmina had become pretty well stabilized back home and everything was looking really well for her, I said to Robin, I took a picture of this young lady, Amelia Baby Kate, she called herself. And I had saw her one night and had was trying to outreach to her when she was in a very manic episode at a parking lot at the 7-Eleven. She was just wild. The next morning, I came out to her and she was just sitting like a defeated person in this trash surrounding her, holding her little teddy bear.
That's when I got the call. Dennis called me and said, we've got another one. And I'm like, well, what's the situation? He's, well, it's like there's a moment, there's a time where, you know, somebody's on the street and they're somewhat stable. And then there's this kind of escalation of events that is generally they're crying out for help themselves. But there's this short time span when everything escalates and you know that something bad is going to happen and that you have to step in at that moment. I guess that's the moment when Dennis called me and said, we need to help this girl, like now. So we kind of mobilized.
As it turned out, you know, we started going out and visiting her daily, a couple times a day, and bringing her food and whatever her needs were at the moment. And then one day we came to see her in the morning and she had a wound on her hand. It's gnarly blood blister like thing the size of her thumb on her hand, and it was really awful. Okay, this is a medical situation here, and what do we do? The next day when we came, the thing was broken open and it was really bad, so we administered first aid, what we knew how to do as well as we could, dressed her wounds twice a day. We had brought the fire department in on the situation and they said, well, she was not well enough to get in the ambulance and go to the hospital. We did what we could as far as administering first aid, and we got the fire department to come out the next day or two later, and they said she really needs antibiotics, which was a real tough thing to try to figure out how we're going to get antibiotics to a patient on the street who's not willing to go see a doctor, who's not willing to get in an ambulance to go to the hospital. And it just became very tense. If we don't get her antibiotics, she's liable to lose her hand or her life. We didn't know. We took pictures of a thing and we're frantically calling out to our people on the social media or anybody. Is there a doctor around? Can somebody? And people are going, that looks like MRSA. You better get her some antibiotics or whatever. We were lucky enough to kind of punk the system a little bit. That's kind of Robin's forte. But
well, let's put it this way. We got her antibiotics.
We got her some antibiotics.
What happens in these circumstances when you talk about how many different agencies are involved in this process, when you get to this moment where it's a catastrophe and this person needs to go to hospital and they're not willing to go, which is generally because of their illness, they don't really have a scalable foresight to what's best for them. There's a moment where the only way somebody qualifies to be able to be forced to be taken to hospital is if they are a danger to other people. It is a danger to themselves, like a life-threatening danger to themselves, like suicidal, or if they're a danger to other people, potentially kill somebody. And that's a very, very difficult line to evaluate. And the police department have a department that specializes in that. It's called the SMART department. They're very good people, actually. The police department and the fire department are dealing with a much bigger problem that's been handed down to them. And of course, whilst they mean well, they see this as a rotating door. And so, of course, they've really become a little bit numb to helping. And it's really officer by officer as to how much somebody's willing to do. And so, again, when Dennis used that term, punking, we tend to force the issue with the... The Rampart Division knows us very well. So do the fire department. They oh, it's these guys again. Okay. Who is it this time?
So how many young women now have you found and helped?
We're on four. We say young women. The last woman that we have advocated for is approximately 65. So she's like somebody's grandmother. She looks
And was it also a mental illness in that case?
Yeah, for want of a better
it's
word.
Ongoing with her.
We specialize, I guess. We had to, because this kind of evolved organically for us, we had to step back at ourselves and say, what are we doing here? I don't know why, but we seem to have a very good communication skill with women on the street.
Well, they are a little more vulnerable, too.
Well, that's the reason. We're like the Titanic, you know, women and children first. There are a lot of agencies that do deal with children, and so thank God. And we care just as much for the men and the boys that are on the street. And if there's an emergency situation, you know, we of course, we don't say, well, you know, you're not in our category or demographic. We'll help anybody. But we just have learned a communication with this particular group of, you know, schizophrenic women. And there seems to be a very quick trust factor that we can build with them. And it is a certain language.
A couple of things I'm thinking about now. One is, these are activities that most people don't do. You talked about how many people would just walk by or drive by these young women, or now an older woman, elderly woman, and just ignore them. It's understandable in some ways. Mm-hmm. And yet, you talked about the mass graves before we turned on the tape. How many people actually die from homelessness?
Unclaimed bodies, the majority are homeless and the rest are poor. But on average, every year in Los Angeles, there's about 1,600 unclaimed bodies that are buried in a mass grave. And the only people that go to grieve on that day are reporters. And you'll find me and Dennis there, along with maybe two, three other social workers. But it's a very sombering moment when the value of life comes down to, you know, I'll backpedal for 1 second. The people, they're like invisible people, I guess. You know, the homeless are the invisible people on the street. You know, we drive past them. We don't want to get involved. You know, we'll, in our own way, create excuses. You know, this is probably somebody who has made bad decisions in life, you know, whether they're a drug addict or a alcoholic or for whatever reason. It's easier to cope with it ourselves if we say this person has made bad decisions and I don't need to be involved. And we're not here to try and make people feel like they need to be doing what we're doing, because it is, you can assess that yourself, how much you can help. If it's raining, bring some socks to people, things, basic things. But I will say, with Wilhelmina as a good example, when she was dirty and wretched and talking to herself at the bus stop, she was invisible. When we started to help her and give her some nutrition and some blankets, and she started to rebuild her health and some clean clothes, she became a young girl. And at that point is when people would say, oh, what's your problem? Do you need any help? So, you know, we have a value system based on beauty. You know, this is, I guess, what we're trying to break down. People are people, you know, and we have to, if there's a way to solve the homeless problem, it's actually not going to be through agencies and people like us. It's going to be through a social context where we take responsibility for our handicapped people. And even an alcoholic is handicapped. They're often self-medicating because of another problem. And so, you know, the answer to ending homelessness is social responsibility. You know, there's enough money. It's not about money. If we can send people to war, we can take care of our homeless vets. If we can develop alcohol and tax alcohol, we can take care of those that fall because of the side effects. If we have handicapped people on our street, we call ourselves a developed country, then we have a responsibility for our handicapped people. You know, again, they can't fill out those forms.
You talked also about, and wanted to create a context for people, about how big this problem really is.
Well, I mean, you know, there's 2.5 to 3.5 million people that experience homelessness every year in America. Of that, 700,000 are on the street on any given day.
Throughout the United States.
In the States. This is America. And 1 in 50 of our children will experience homelessness. You know, 1,500, 1.5 million more people since 2008, since the economic collapse, are experiencing homelessness. Without being over political, if we are foreclosing people's houses and we're creating, you know, this huge catalog of empty buildings. You know, there's enough buildings downtown LA empty that they're not specialized enough to house the homeless. However, there's enough keys to go around. It's just whether we decide we want to change this.
Any last word, Dennis Davis?
I would just say that there's a great disconnect that I don't quite understand when we look at ourselves as a species, as human beings, how we can disconnect ourselves from each other and allow those less fortunate or those that are ill to just perish. There has to be a sea change within our consciousness to actually try to solve the problem. It's a huge, huge problem, but it starts within ourselves. And if we can just do that, at least recognize within ourselves that we are all human beings on this planet. That wretch that looks like a piece of trash over there, rags, that there's a person underneath of that.
The two of you, having met because of a homeless woman at the bus stop, have now helped four women and have decided now that there is a missing piece and have therefore created an organization. Yeah. You're just launching it. Give us a website.
It's called Goal, G-O-A-L, foundation.org.
Goal Foundation, G-O-A-L, foundation.org. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, why are so many people without homes, and what can be done about it? Next up on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
When we are homeless, we are homeless. When moonlight's sleeping on a midnight lake, and we are homeless,
homeless,
homeless.
Boom, boom.
Moonlight's sleeping on a midnight lake.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. By some counts, an estimated 2.3 to 3.5 million people experience homelessness in America in a given year. Why are so many people without homes? What are the realities for the homeless? How are the very poor faring? And what can be done about it? We're joined by three experts. Samson Barris is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing. Among his publications are Housing First, the Pathways Model to End Homelessness for People with a Mental Illness and Addiction Manual. James Bumall is professor of the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. His publications include Homeless in America and Down and Out in Berkeley, an overview of a study of street people. Kim Hopper is a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. His publications include Reckoning with Homelessness. He's also co-editor of the forthcoming Recovery from Schizophrenia, an International Perspective. Thank you so much for being with us. Can we get a sense of what the realities are with regards to homelessness and the trends that are occurring? Jim Bumall.
I can't tell you how many of what type and where they are, and I think, frankly, that anybody who says they can is fudging. There are just so many problems with how we define homelessness and how we count who's homeless that the numbers really don't make that much of a difference. What we know is that there are a lot of people in shelters, and there are a lot of people who are doubled up with friends, families, sleeping in all kinds of places that human beings weren't meant to sleep. And that's getting worse. From what I understand, family homelessness, by which I mean one or more adults with kids in tow, is the single fastest growing group among homeless people. And given the nature of our economy and the nature of our public assistance system, that's hardly a surprise.
Kim Hopper?
the most interesting attempt ever to estimate the overall numbers of people who have been in and out of homelessness over a particular period of time was done by some researchers at Columbia in the 90s. They had asked people about their attitudes towards homeless people, and they wondered whether having been homeless yourself might affect those attitudes. So they added a tiny little question about your own history as homeless, and they discovered that about 3% of their respondents had been homeless during the last 5 years of the 1980s, which was a huge number, much larger than anybody had been talking about at the time. But it sort of alerted us to the fact that much of this is invisible, much of it is evanescent, some of it is episodic, and the part we see tends to be chronic, sort of in your face or on somebody's shelter roster.
This is Jim Baumol. I think the most important thing for people to understand in a general sense is that we've returned to the period that extended from basically the 1870s until the end of the Great Depression, when being homeless was a really common experience of working class families for some usually short period of time. And I think the figures that researchers at Penn came up with a few years ago in looking at the shelter systems in both New York and Philadelphia was that some phenomenal figure, like 9% of all African American children spend some time homeless.
That is quite remarkable.
That's stunning.
Samson Barris?
I sort of think of this in two ways. From what Jim is saying, historically, since the 1980s in this country, since the Reagan administration, the income disparity in the United States has gone from 0.30 to 0.47, meaning that the difference between rich and poor is growing every year. Now, why that's important, as the Occupy Wall Street people pointed out across the country, is that that kind of income disparity is correlated to social problems, homelessness being among them. So that we have, since the 1980s, this steady increase in the number of people homeless, and Jim and Kim both point out that families are the fastest growing number. Most painful in that story is the fact that in the New York City shelter system, where about 28,000 families, which is 90% women with children, show up, the reason that they end up homeless, the primary reason they get for being homeless, is that their child got sick. So the child gets sick, either you take off work, you lose your job because you're taking care of your kid, or you have to pay the doctor's bill and you can't pay the rent, and you end up in the shelter system. So that the homelessness is just sort of the tip of an iceberg of income disparity, no national health plan, no living wage. You know, it's just sort of the what we see above the surface of structural problems that are generating more and more homeless people, and we're not really even talking about the foundational problems that keep contributing to this homelessness issue.
So you said since the 1980s, but as I understand, this is a phenomenon that really did go farther back, just didn't accelerate as much since the 1980s. What are the structural or policy or other factors that are driving this?
This is Jim Baumol. We could talk about nuances. There are lots of rivulets that feed the larger stream. But the basic issue of homelessness, regardless of someone's mental health, their history of addiction, is the mismatch between income and the cost of housing. That's the bottom line, so to speak. Homeless people don't fall out of the middle class, by and large. They fall out of normal poverty. Homelessness is becoming part of normal poverty. And they can't earn a wage that will pay for housing. And those jobs are not coming back unless we create them. And that's not what we're talking about in terms of public policy today. I think the real scary thing, as Sam mentioned, about income disparities, is that nobody's talking about how we're going to react to a huge oversupply of unskilled labor in all of the major cities in the United States, except maybe a place like San Francisco, and that's a little peculiar. God knows what it's going to look like in 10 years. And so we've narrowed our focus and we've cheapened our goals by talking about, we won't solve homelessness this millennium, we'll solve chronic homelessness. And then we define chronic homelessness really to be a problem of people with very serious psychiatric or physical impairments who have been homeless for a long time.
because we've got a benefit system that at least supports them at a very, very modest level.
You've mentioned the issue of mental illness, and I understand there is quite a large percentage. I think, Jim Bumall, I saw in one of your older papers, something like 22% of homeless dealt with some kind of mental illness.
It depends where you count them and how you ask them about mental illness. Yeah, there's a significant portion of homeless people, if we're talking about people in shelters, who have a reasonably recent history of serious mental illness. But the thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of people with serious mental illnesses are not homeless. So to characterize the problem that way is to misread the connection between material well-being and the ability to stay in a home and symptoms of mental disorder. I think Sam can probably speak very directly to this because this is really his bread and butter.
Samson Barris, let's bring you back.
There is certainly a relationship between homelessness and mental illness in the same way that there's a relationship between homelessness and anybody else. So when you're homeless, you're going to get a lot worse. But the relationship between homelessness and mental illness is not a psychiatric or mental health relationship. It's an economic relationship primarily because people who have a severe psychiatric disability are on Social Security or disability income, which is among the lowest incomes. I mean, welfare is even lower than that. But currently, people are getting something like $700 a month for their entire expenses. That includes lodging and food and medicine if they're taking it and so on. So that the people who are most at risk are the poorest of people, and among the poorest are people on fixed income. So when simple things happen, like their lease is renewed and the rent goes up by 3% or 5%, that is a risk factor for bringing them into homelessness. It's the appearance of so many people among the homeless, definitely overrepresented. People with severe mental illness is not so much that they are because of their psychosis rendered homeless, it's because they're too poor to stay housed.
Kim Hopper.
Well, or that they become sort of less eligible or less desirable as potential rental tenants. And there's a really interesting lesson in there. For the past 30 years, most of the time, having a mental illness was two strikes against you as far as getting out of homelessness. And then people like Simbaris came along, and they showed that with proper supports and the money to make the rent on a regular basis, those folks could live decent, stable, non-homeless lives on their own. And all of a sudden, homelessness went from being a risk factor for staying in the shelter to a handicap for getting out of the shelter. So it really makes the point both Jim and Samuel are making, that mental illness only serves as a tipping factor, one way or the other, in a given context. Most of the time, it makes you less competitive in a housing market. But when programs are designed that specifically target these populations, it can actually give you a leg up on exiting homelessness.
Let's talk for a bit about society and how our society responds to this issue. Here in Los Angeles, we've seen homeless people be essentially pushed off into one corner so people won't see them. It seems like the trend is that the numbers are getting bigger and might even get larger given what's happening with foreclosures and such. How do we understand society's response related to the problem itself? Kim Hopper, isn't this your area?
Part of my area. I mean, it's supposed to be my area as an anthropologist, but I think there are probably two parts to that. One is that I think, in part, a great deal of accommodating activity goes on sort of backstage. And so the part of society's response that we don't see are all those people who are doubling up with friends and family, often on extremely long periods of time, that attest to a kind of moral economy of helping one another out that very rarely gets any credit. But if it weren't there, the burden on public shelter facilities would be astronomical. It would just be completely insupportable. On the other hand, in the public spaces, there's pretty much an unwritten law that, for the most part, at least from the 1970s on, the idea of an overt spectacle of pain being part of the urban landscape has been really not the best way of advertising your city. So rendering people invisible, either through shelters or through the destruction of shanty towns or through just buying people a bus ticket someplace else, has been a very common practice. But that's, I think, only the tip of a much larger story about ordinary folks are helping each other out so that the public relief system can actually work.
You know, I think if people in your audience want to ask themselves, well, how close am I to this, or how close is someone I love to this, the Census Bureau, I haven't seen the specific data, but I know roughly what they're going to be. Since 1960, the Census Bureau has been asking people if they have an adult between 18 and 35, related adult living in their household. That number's been going up every year since every census since 1960, and the 2010 census will have the highest figures ever, and they will be much higher than they were in 2000. And that testifies to the absorptive capacity of families to take their kids back in. You know, it's kind of a standing joke now with the boomerang kids. But a lot of that is that the cost of establishing an independent household is so extraordinary today that the people avoid homelessness, young people, by going home. Now, if you've grown up in foster care and you are what amounts to a social orphan, or if your family can't take you in, they don't have the room, they don't have the extra resources, you're out of luck. And this, again, is distinctly related to economic class origin, so that there's an awful lot of homelessness being essentially prevented in the middle class and higher regions by parents who can afford to take their kids back. And if it weren't for that, as Kim points out, we would be swimming in. You couldn't walk out your front door in the morning without somebody sleeping on your lawn.
The estimates for that period of young people in their 20s, in just about 10 years, it's gone from about one-third of them at some point having to return home, or what counts for home, to about a half of them in the last attempt to estimate this about a year or two ago. So it's, as Jim is saying, it's going up and getting harder to make it through that critical transitional decade without some help on the home front.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking about homelessness in America with James Bummel, professor of the Bryn Mawr College, Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research, Samson Barris, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing, Kim Hopper, a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. Given the pervasiveness of this and the trends which seem to be moving upward, how do we explain a reasonable representative democracy dealing with it in the way that it is dealing with it today? Jim Bummel, I overheard you criticizing the Republicans.
Surprise.
I would be equally critical in many respects to the Democrats, by the way. It's trite to say that it's just not a priority. But in many respects, that's the case. And to the extent that we associate homelessness with public disorder, addiction, with mental illness, and we don't appreciate the logic that Sam discussed so well, we mistake an economic problem for something else. And in that respect, I think the media have failed us and failed homeless people in some ways, in that, and quite honestly, my colleagues in academe have largely been bought off by technical studies and interest in technical small fixes for program interventions. And while I wouldn't argue that that isn't necessary, we know how to rehouse people, and it simply requires the political will to do so, and that requires a movement behind it that has flagged badly in the last 10 or 15 years, I'm afraid.
This is Sam. I agree with this last piece. I agree with all of it, but the last piece in particular, I think that we have a fundamental issue in terms of what is our social covenant and who are we. You know, are we no longer welcoming the tired and the poor among us? And there, we have created a language and even a science and programming around homeless people that is a practice of separation. These are homeless, these are families, these are mentally ill. You know, different disciplines study them, different people treat them, but every one of those labels and diagnostic categories creates yet another level of separation where it's them and what are we going to do about them. And so that sort of as a society sort of defends us from seeing the problem as us. And, you know, the image that comes to mind for me is what happens when someone is housed. There was one particular woman who had been homeless in D.C., and she was showing us around her neighborhood because where she wanted to be rehoused was in the neighborhood where she had been homeless. It was familiar to her. She'd been there for years. And she's walking around the same blocks, and she's introducing us to people. And she says, oh, here's the church, she says, where I used to sleep outside. And the reason I go now on Sundays to this minister's church is because when I was homeless, he didn't push me away. And then she takes us over to the bodega, and the grocer, you know, she opens the door, says hello. The guy says hello back very warmly. And she turns and says, you know, he used to chase me out. When I was homeless, I would go in there. I would steal stuff. He called the police on me. Now I shop there all the time. We're like the best of friends. Same thing for the haircutting place. And person after person in that community, happy to see her, enjoying her success. And I think if we could somehow, and I'm just using that image metaphorically, if we could understand that the solution to homelessness is essential for all of us, for all of our societal well-being, it'll be a healing at a much larger level. I think that has to be the starting point where that becomes important enough then to take it on as a real issue of a cohesive social contract as opposed to fixing and addressing it as a separate issue.
Well, that actually brings up a couple of things. One is, what are the costs to society to maintain this us and them system where we look away from our fellow brothers and sisters and neighbors and such? What are the costs to society, both, say, psychosocially and economically?
So I'll tell you just from, this is Sam, it does not go unnoticed when you walk past a person who's homeless and you don't look at them. They feel the pain of that rejection. And people are very articulate about it when, you know, after you get to know people on the street and how that makes them feel, and the level of pain and anger associated with those feelings. I think that on the other end, on the passers-by end, I think there is a sort of a psychological shutting down, that you have to sort of see someone hurting that much and be able to walk past them is a cost on a spiritual level, if nothing else, of shutting yourself down empathically to be able to tolerate that. I think it's, you know, the cost of that on an emotional level is one thing. But there's also an actual cost we haven't talked about at all. The cost of homelessness is not insignificant. There's lots of good research that talks about police surveillance activity, in and out of jail, detox, emergency rooms, the institutional circuit, as Kim calls it, of people going in and out of these acute care services with great frequency and still ending up back on the street is an enormous taxpayer cost without a real solution, and a burden to the providers of those acute care services, and completely ineffective. And I mean, just yells speak so loudly for the need for a permanent housing solution.
Kim Hopper?
I mean, one of the most remarkable research findings that I recall from the 90s is some very close work that Dennis Culhane and his colleagues did on programs like the one that Sam Sembaris runs in New York City. And they compared what it cost to let people essentially fend for themselves on the street with all those additional services that Sam just articulated with respect to police and ambulances and emergency rooms and detox facilities and occasional use of emergency shelters versus a completely predictable, regular, stabilized life in supported housing. And the costs between the two of them were essentially a wash at about $41,000 a year. So it cost the city of New York $41,000 for somebody who's essentially on their own on the street. And it cost about the same to house them with dignity, regularity, and security. So that's one anomaly. I think the other part that nobody wants to talk about is that one of the reasons we treat people so badly when they become desperately poor actually has sort of two parts to it. One is, this is a kind of social death, and like regular death, it's really hard to be close to because you see yourself reflected in that predicament. And I think particularly in times of sort of increasing economic distress, people have a hard time facing up to the fact that this extreme version of dispossession is something that may be not too alien or distant in their own future. And the second part of that is, by keeping the conditions of people who are actually sheltered in fairly wretched circumstances, with the, you know, the courts doing the best they can, legal aid lawyers building protections where they can find purchase, by keeping it a sort of shameful, wretched way of life, you bolster the motivation of all those people who are doubling up to stay out of the public system, and sort of indirectly deter people from using
a resource they could really benefit from if it worked well, and instead stay with friends and family.
If I may, I think maybe the most telling question with respect to the points that Kim has raised, that the question that I ask my kids, for example, is, can you stand the feeling of insecurity and shame living in Dickensian London? Or you're in Los Angeles, living under the conditions portrayed in Blade Runner. Now, those are pretty dramatic, and you can seal yourself away in a suburb and have to deal with it very rarely. But if you live in a big city, you see it every day, and it takes an enormous toll. And it's impossible to prove, but I would suspect that it reverberates throughout our lives individually and collectively. It's painful to have to segregate the stuff and deny it and refuse to ask the questions about what constitutes fairness in society.
That brings me to the conclusion that I'd like to get to. There are a couple of gentlemen that we just interviewed who have been essentially rescuing homeless women in the streets and helping them get through the system just because these women were there living in a bus stop near their home. And they have struggled so much to get through the bureaucracy to get them fundamental care. They're not trained in this way, but it says something about the system that is set up to protect people who fall out of the safety net and what the problems are within it, in the system, that prevent people from getting back into society. What can we do to have a system that is not quite so complicated? Sam Simbaris, maybe you should take the lead on this.
I can't answer the question about why we have made things so difficult for people to get back once they fall out. But they are indeed a very, very steep climb. And it's still the predominant view today. I think, it must go back to this moral perspective of, if you are somehow on the street, that either you were born of equal wealth, but somehow you've squandered it, and therefore not deserving. You have to earn the benefits. You know, we're in a country where we don't have housing as a basic human right. We don't even have health care as a basic human right, or education as affordable. We started the conversation earlier about the structural problems that contribute to homelessness. So the way out of homelessness is, of course, housing quickly, but that still leaves health, education, the livable wage, you know, as another great hill to climb post-housing. There are people that spend a lot of time worried about hazard ratios and how exactly to set the bar at a certain level of difficulty where people will not take advantage. This is sort of the prevailing policy and political view, of both the Democratic and Republican administrations. It's a very different view than a view, let's say, that is enjoyed in Canada or in Europe, where there's a different kind of social contract, where people have a majority belief that says, we're going to take care of the most vulnerable among us. When you apply for benefits, we're going to make the process easy. It'll be easy to renew. When you apply for disability, we're going to also include a shelter allowance because we know you'll be struggling to pay the rent. This is not written in stone. We don't have to do it this way. There are so many good models of doing it much, much better. And as I don't know if it was Kim or Jim that said earlier, you know, this issue of political will, it's all about a shared decision-making, if you will, about how we can make things much easier for people to get out of homelessness if we want it to be so.
This is Jim Baumol. We create policies that are deliberately designed to demand that ordinary people act like heroes, which is by definition impossible. And those policies are doomed. They can't possibly work. But they're not designed to work. I mean, I don't want to sound too cynical, but I would argue that most service systems are designed to conserve their resources, not to spend them. And that involves them in making invidious distinction after invidious distinction, putting the burden on people to prove that they are so colossally desperate that they will do anything to get what you have to offer. And we do that because we think otherwise we're going to be cheated, that we're going to be taken advantage of. And we focus on the very small number of people who have that attitude, instead of understanding that by focusing policy on that very small number of people, we're missing the point, and we are failing to serve adequately or support adequately the vast majority of people who are in trouble. And this is not an attitude that begins with Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan's presidency, and the people particularly that he brought from the State Department of Social Welfare with him to Washington, brought that attitude into contemporary social welfare politics.
Kim Hopper, you get the last word.
Amartya Sen has raised the level of quality of life with respect to the so-called developing world by asking whether people have a life worth living, or a life that they have reason to value. If we applied that same criterion to our own domestic front, I think we would have a hard time avoiding a lot of shame.
And I'm going to end it right there at Jim Bummel, Samson Barris, and Kim Hopper. Thank you all so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Samson Barris is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing. Among his publications are Housing First, The Pathways Model to End Homelessness for People with a Mental Illness and Addiction Manual. James Bummel is professor of the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. His publications include Homeless in America and Down and Out in Berkeley, An Overview of a Study of Street People. Kim Hopper is a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. His publications include Reckoning with Homelessness. He's also co-editor of the forthcoming Recovery from Schizophrenia, An International Perspective. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre and iConnect, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening, and if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.
Once I built a railroad, made it wrong, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sea,